How often do you chat with your friend?
Occasionally.
Herman objected to the strike this morning, did you know that?
No.
He was the only one of the 14.
Why'd they strike?
Conditions. Phones, TV, beer, sex, church, the usual yearnings of mankind.
Who led the strike?
Same one who's been leading from day one.
I see.
That's why I'm here, Fitch. If my friend was not in control, I'd have nothing to offer.
And what are you offering?
I said we wouldn't talk about money now. The waiter set the fresh glass in front of Fitch and again asked Marley if she wanted something to drink.
Yes. A Diet Cola in a plastic cup, please.
We don't have any plastic cups, the waiter said with a puzzled look at Fitch.
Then forget it,
she said, grinning at Fitch.
Fitch decided to press on.
What's the mood of the jury right now?
Getting bored. Herrera's a big fan, thinks trial lawyers are dirt and severe restrictions should be placed on frivolous lawsuits.
My hero. Can he convince his pals?
No, he has no pals. He is despised by all, definitely the most disliked member of the panel.
Who's the friendliest girl?
Millie is everybody's mother, but she won't be a factor. Ricky is cute and popular and very health-conscious. She's trouble for you.
That's no surprise.
Do you want a surprise, Fitch?
Yeah, surprise me.
Which juror has actually started smoking cigarettes since the trial started?
Fitch squinted and cocked his head a little to the left. Did he hear her correctly? Started smoking?
Yep.
I give up.
Easter. Surprised?
Your friend.
Yeah. Look, Fitch, gotta run. I'll call you tomorrow.
She was on her feet and gone, disappearing as quickly as she'd come. Dante, with a hired woman, reacted before Fitch, who was stunned for a second with the speed of her departure. Dante radioed Pang in the lobby, who saw her exit the elevator and leave the hotel. Jumper tracked her on foot for 2 blocks before losing her in a crowded alley. For an hour, they watched the streets and parking garages and hotel lobbies and bars, but did not see her. Fitch was in his room at the St. Regis when the call came from Dubaz, who'd been dispatched to the airport. She was waiting for a commuter flight that left in an hour and a half and landed in Mobile at 10:50. Don't follow her, Fitch instructed him, then called 2 standbys in Biloxi, who raced to the airport in Mobile. Marley lived in a rented condo facing the back bay of Biloxi. When she was 20 minutes from home, she called the Biloxi police by dialing 911 on her cell phone and explained to the dispatcher that a Ford Taurus with 2 thugs in it was following her, had been, in fact, since she left Mobile, that they were stalkers of some odious variety, and she was fearful for her life. With the dispatcher coordinating movements, Marley did a series of turns through a quiet subdivision and abruptly stopped at an all-night gas station. As she filled her tank, a police car pulled behind the Taurus, which was trying to hide around the corner of a closed dry cleaner. The 2 thugs were ordered out, then marched across the parking lot to face the woman they'd been stalking. Marley performed superbly as the terrified victim. The cops got angrier the more she cried. Fitch's goons were hauled away to jail. At 10, Chuck, the large deputy with a sullen attitude, unfolded a chair at the end of the hallway near his room and set up watch for the night. It was Wednesday, the second night of sequestration, and time to breach security. As planned, Nicholas phoned Chuck's room at 11:15. The instant he left his post to answer it, Jerry and Nicholas slipped from their rooms and walked casually through the exit door near Lou Dell's room. Lou Dell was in bed, sound asleep. And though Willis had slept most of the day in court, he too was under the covers, snoring furiously. Avoiding the front lobby, they eased through the shadows and found the taxi waiting precisely as instructed. 15 minutes later, they entered the Nugget Casino on Biloxi Beach. They drank 3 beers in the sports bar as Jerry lost $100 on a hockey game. They flirted with 2 married women whose husbands were either winning or losing a fortune at the crap tables. The flirting took a turn toward serious, and at 1 a.m. Nicholas left the bar to play $5 blackjack and drink decaf coffee. He played and waited and watched as the crowd dwindled. Marley slipped into the chair next to him and said nothing.
Nicholas pushed a short stack of chips in front of her. A drunk college boy was the only other player.
Upstairs, she whispered between hands as the dealer turned to talk to the pit boss.
They met on an outdoor mezzanine with a view of the parking lot and the ocean in the distance. November had arrived and the air was light and cool. There was no one else around. They kissed and huddled together on a bench. She replayed her trip to New Orleans, every detail, every word. They laughed at the two boys from Mobile who were now in the county jail. She'd call Fitch after daybreak and get his men released. They talked business briefly because Nicholas wanted to return to the bar and collect Jerry before he drank too much and lost all his money or got caught with somebody's wife. They each had slim pocket cell phones which could not be completely secured. New codes and passwords were exchanged. Nicholas kissed her goodbye and left her alone on the mezzanine. Wendell Rohr had a hunch the jury was tired of listening to researchers tout their findings and lecture from their charts and graphs. His consultants were telling him the jurors had heard enough about lung cancer and smoking that they had probably been convinced before the trial started that cigarettes were addictive and dangerous. He was confident he had established a strong causal relationship between the Bristols and the tumors that killed Jacob Wood, and it was now time to ice the case. Thursday morning, he announced that the plaintiff would like to call Lawrence Krigler as its next witness. A noticeable tension seized the defense table for the moment it took to call Mr. Krigler from somewhere in the rear. Another plaintiff's lawyer, John Riley Milton from Denver, rose and smiled sweetly at the jury. Lawrence Krigler was in his late 60s, tanned and fit, well-dressed and quick in step. He was the first witness without doctor stuck to the front of his name since the video of Jacob Wood. He lived now in Florida, where he'd retired after he left Pinex. John Riley Milton rushed him through the preliminaries because the juicy stuff was just around the corner. An engineering graduate of North Carolina State, he'd worked for Pinex for 30 years before leaving in the midst of a lawsuit 13 years earlier. He'd sued Pinex. The company'd countersued him. They settled out of court, with terms being non-disclosed. When he was first hired, the company, then called Union Tobacco, or simply UTAB, had shipped him to Cuba to study tobacco production down there. He'd worked in production ever since, or at least until the day he left. He'd studied the tobacco leaf and 1,000 ways to grow it more efficiently. He considered himself an expert in this field, though he was not testifying as an expert and would not offer opinions. Only facts. In 1969, he completed a 3-year in-house study on the feasibility of growing an experimental tobacco leaf known only as Raleigh 4. It had 1/3 the nicotine of regular tobacco. Krigler concluded, with a wealth of research to support him, that Raleigh 4 could be grown and produced as efficiently as all other tobaccos then grown and produced by UTAB. It was a monumental work, one he was quite proud of. And he was devastated when his study was at first ignored by higher-ups within his company. He slogged his way through the entrenched bureaucracy above him with disheartening results. No one seemed to care about this new strain of tobacco with much less nicotine. Then he learned that he was very wrong. His bosses cared a great deal about nicotine levels. In the summer of 1971, he got his hands on an intercompany memo instructing upper management to quietly do whatever possible to discredit Krigler's work with Raleigh 4. His own people were silently knifing him in the back. He kept his cool, told no one he had the memo, and began a clandestine project to learn the reasons for the conspiracy against him. At this point in his testimony, John Riley Milton introduced into evidence two exhibits, the thick study Krigler completed in 1969 and the 1971 memo. The answer became crystal clear, and it was something he'd come to suspect. UTAB could not afford to produce a leaf with markedly lower nicotine because nicotine meant profits. The industry had known since the late 30s that nicotine was physically addictive. How do you know the industry knew? Milton asked very deliberately. With the exception of the defense lawyers, who were doing their best to appear bored and indifferent, the entire courtroom was listening with rapt attention. It's common knowledge within the industry, Krigler answered.
There was a secret study in the late 1930s, paid for by a tobacco company, and the result was clear proof that the nicotine in cigarettes is addictive.
Have you seen this report?
No, as you might guess, it has been well concealed.
Krigler paused and looked at the defense table. The bombshell was coming, and he was thoroughly enjoying the moment.
But I saw a memo.
Objection! Cable shouted as he rose. This witness cannot state what he may or may not have seen in a written document. The reasons are plentiful, and I set out more fully in the brief we filed on this point.
The brief was 80 pages long and had been argued over for a month now. Judge Harkin had already ruled in writing.
The objection is noted, Mr. Cable. Mr. Krigler, you may continue.
In the winter of 1973, I saw a one-page memo summarizing the nicotine study from the 1930s. The memo had been copied many times, was very old, and had been slightly altered.
Altered in what way?
The date had been deleted, as had the name of the person sending it.
To whom was it sent?
It was addressed to Sander S. Fraley, who at that time was the president of Allegheny Growers, the predecessor of a company now called Conpac.
A tobacco company?
Yes, basically. It calls itself a consumer products company, but the bulk of its business is manufacturing cigarettes.
When did he serve as president?
From 1931 to 1942.
Is it then safe to assume the memo was sent prior to 1942?
Yes, Mr. Fraley died in 1942.
Where were you when you saw this memo?
At a Pinex facility in Richmond. When Pinex was still Union Tobacco, its corporate headquarters were in Richmond. In 1979, it changed its name and moved to New Jersey. But the buildings are still in use in Richmond, and that's where I worked until I left. Most of the company's old records are there, and a person I know showed me the memo.
Who was this person?
He was a friend, and he's now dead. I promised him I'd never reveal his identity.
Did you actually hold the memo?
Yes. In fact, I made a copy of it.
And where is your copy?
It didn't last long. The day after I locked it in my desk drawer, I was called out of town on business. While I was out, someone went through my desk and removed a number of things, including my copy of the memo.
Do you recall what the memo said?
I remember very well. Keep in mind, for a long time, I'd been digging for some confirmation of what I suspected. Seeing the memo was an unforgettable moment.
What did it say?
Three paragraphs, maybe four. Brief and to the point. The writer explained that he had just read the nicotine report that was secretly shown to him by the head of research at Allegheny Growers, a person who went unnamed in the memo. In his opinion, the study proved conclusively and beyond any doubt that nicotine is addictive. As I recall, this was the gist of the first two paragraphs.
And the next paragraph?
The writer suggested to Fraley that the company take a serious look at increasing the nicotine levels in its cigarettes. More nicotine meant more smokers, which meant more sales and more profits.
Krigler delivered his lines with a fine flair for the dramatic, and every ear soaked up his words.
The jurors, for the first time in days, watched every move the witness made. The word profits floated over the courtroom and hung like a dirty fog.
John Riley Milton paused for a bit, then said,
"Now let's keep this straight. The memo was prepared by someone at another company and sent to the president of that company, right?"
"That's correct.
A company that was then and is now a competitor of Pinex."
"That's correct."
"How did the memo find its way to Pinex in 1973?
"I never found out. But Pinex certainly knew about the study. In fact, the entire tobacco industry knew about the study by the early 1970s, if not sooner."
"How do you know this?"
"I worked in the industry for 30 years, remember? And I spent my career in production. I talked to a lot of people, especially my counterparts at other companies. Let's just say that the tobacco companies at times can stick together."
"Did you ever attempt to obtain another copy of the memo from your friend?"
"I tried. It didn't work. Let's leave it at that." Except for the usual 15-minute coffee break at 10:30, Krigler testified non-stop for the 3-hour morning session. His testimony passed by as if it were only a matter of minutes and was a crucial moment in the trial. The drama of an ex-employee spilling dirty secrets was played to perfection. The jurors even ignored their customary longings for lunch. The lawyers watched the jurors more closely than ever, and the judge seemed to write down every word the witness said. The reporters were unusually reverent, the jury consultants unusually attentive. The watchdogs from Wall Street counted the minutes until they could bolt from the room and make breathless phone calls to New York. The bored local lawyers hanging around the courtroom would talk about the testimony for years. Even Lou Dell stopped her knitting on the front row. Fitch watched and listened from the viewing room next to his office. Krigler had been scheduled to testify early next week, and then there'd been the chance that he wouldn't testify at all. Fitch was one of the few people still alive who'd actually seen the memo, and Krigler had described it with amazing recollection. It was clear to everyone, even Fitch, that the witness was telling the truth. One of Fitch's first assignments 9 years ago when he'd first been hired by the Big Four was to track down every copy of the memo and destroy each one. He was still working on it. Neither Cable nor any defense lawyer retained by Fitch so far had seen the memo. The admissibility of its existence in court had caused a small war. The rules of evidence normally prevent such verbal descriptions of lost documents for obvious reasons. The best evidence is the document itself. But, as with every area of the law, there are exceptions, and exceptions to the exceptions, and Rohr et al. Had done a masterful job of convincing Judge Harkin that the jury should hear Krigler's description of what was, in effect, a lost document. Cable's cross-examination that afternoon would be brutal, but the damage was done. Fitch skipped lunch and locked himself in his office. In the jury room, the atmosphere over lunch was remarkably different. The ordinary drivel about football and recipes was replaced by a virtual silence. As a deliberative body, the jury had been lulled into stupor with 2 weeks of tedious scientific testimony from experts who were being paid large sums of money to travel to Biloxi and lecture. Now the jury had been shaken back to life with Krigler's sensational inside dirt. They ate less and stared more. Most wanted to ease into another room with their favorite friend and replay what they'd just heard. Did they hear it right? Did everyone understand what the man just said? They intentionally kept nicotine high so people got hooked. They managed to do just that. The smokers, only three now since Stella had departed, though Easter was a semi-smoker because he preferred to spend time with Jerry and Poodle and Angel Wheeze, ate quickly, then excused themselves. They all sat on folding chairs, staring and puffing at the open window. With the weighted nicotine, the cigarettes felt a bit heavier. But when Nicholas said so, no one laughed. Mrs. Gladys Card and Millie Dupree managed to leave for the restroom at the same moment. They took a long pee, then spent 15 minutes washing their hands and speaking to each other in front of the mirror. They were joined in mid-conversation by Loreen Duke, who leaned by the towel dispenser and quickly threw in her amazement and disgust with tobacco companies. After the table was cleared, Lonnie Shaver opened his laptop 2 chairs down from Herman, who had his Braille machine plugged in and was typing away. The colonel said to Herman, "Don't guess you need a translator for that testimony, do you?" To which Herman replied with a grunt and said, "Pretty amazing, I'd say." That was the nearest Herman Grimes came to discussing any aspect of the case. Lonnie Shaver was not amazed or impressed by anything. Philip Savelle had politely asked for and received permission from Judge Harkin to spend part of his lunch break doing yoga under a large oak tree behind the courthouse. He was escorted by a deputy to the oak tree, where he removed his shirt, socks, and shoes, then sat on the soft grass and creased himself into a pretzel. When he began chanting, the deputy slid away to a nearby concrete bench and lowered his face so no one would recognize him. Cable said hello to Krigler as if the two were old friends. Krigler smiled and said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Cable," with an abundance of confidence. 7 months earlier, in Rohr's office, Cable and Company had spent 3 days taking a video deposition of Krigler. The video had been watched and studied by no fewer than 24 lawyers and several jury experts and even 2 psychiatrists. Krigler was telling the truth, but the truth needed to be blurred at this point. This was a cross-examination, a crucial one, so to hell with the truth. The witness had to be discredited. After hundreds of hours of plotting, a strategy had been developed. Cable began by asking Krigler if he was angry with his former employer.
"Yes," he answered. "Do you hate the company?"
"The company is an entity. How do you hate a thing?"
"Do you hate war?"
"Never been."
"Do you hate child abuse?"
"I'm sure it's sickening, but luckily I've never had any connection with it."
"Do you hate violence?"
"I'm sure it's awful, but again, I've been lucky."
"So you don't hate anything?"
"Broccoli."
A gentle laugh came from all quarters of the courtroom, and Cable knew he had his hands full. "You don't hate Pinex?"
"No."
"Do you hate anyone who works there?"
"No, I dislike some of them."
"Did you hate anyone who worked there when you worked there?"
"No, I had some enemies, but I don't remember hating anyone."
"What about the people against whom you directed your lawsuit?"
"No.
Again, they were enemies, but they were just doing their jobs." "So you love your enemies?"
"Not really. I know I'm supposed to try, but it sure is difficult. I don't recall saying I loved them."
Cable had hoped to score a minor point by injecting the possibility of retribution or revenge on the part of Krigler. Maybe if he used the word hate enough, it might stick with some of the jurors. "What is your motive for testifying here?"
"That's a complicated question."
"Is it money?"
"No."
"Are you being paid by Mr. Rohr or anyone working for the plaintiff to come and testify?"
"No. They've agreed to reimburse me for my travel expenses, but that's all."
The last thing Cable wanted was an open door for Krigler to expound upon his reasons for testifying. He had touched on them briefly during Milton's direct examination, and he'd spent 5 hours detailing them during the video deposition. It was crucial to keep him occupied with other matters. "Have you ever smoked cigarettes, Mr. Krigler?"
"Yes, unfortunately I smoked for 20 years.
"So you wished you'd never smoked?"
"Of course."
"When did you start?"
"When I went to work for the company, 1952. Back then they encouraged all their employees to smoke cigarettes. They still do."
"Do you believe you damaged your health by smoking for 20 years?
"Of course. I feel lucky I'm not dead like Mr. Wood."
"When did you quit?"
"In 1973, after I learned the truth about nicotine."
"Do you feel your present health has been diminished in some way because you smoked for 20 years?
"Of course."
"In your opinion, was the company responsible in any way for your decision to smoke cigarettes?"
"Yes. As I said, it was encouraged. Everybody else smoked. We could purchase cigarettes at half price in the company store. Every meeting began with a bowl of cigarettes passed around. It was very much a part of the culture."
"Were your offices ventilated?"
"No."
"How bad was the secondhand smoke?"
"Very bad. There was always a blue fog hanging not far over your head."
"So you blame the company today because you're not as healthy as you think you should be?"
"The company had a lot to do with it. Fortunately, I was able to kick the habit. It wasn't easy."
"And you hold a grudge against the company for this?"
"Let's just say I wish I'd gone to work in another industry when I finished college."
"Industry? Do you carry a grudge against the entire industry?"
"I'm not a fan of the tobacco industry."
"Is that why you're here?"
"No."
Cable flipped his notes and quickly changed direction. "Now, you had a sister at one time, didn't you, Mr. Krigler?"
"I did."
"What happened to her?"
"She died in 1970.
"How'd she die?"
"Lung cancer. She smoked 2 packs a day for about 23 years. Smoking killed her, Mr. Cable, if that's what you want."
"Were you close to her?" Cable asked with enough compassion to deflect some of the ill will for bringing up the tragedy in the first place.
"We were very close. She was my only sibling."
And you took her death very hard.
I did. She was a very special person, and I still miss her.
I'm sorry to bring this up, Mr. Krigler, but it is relevant.
Your compassion is overwhelming, Mr. Cable, but there's nothing relevant about it.
How did she feel about your smoking?
She didn't like it. As she was dying, she begged me to stop. Is that what you want to hear, Mr. Cable?
Only if it's the truth.
Oh, it's true, Mr. Cable. The day before she died, I promised I would quit smoking. And I did, though it took me 3 long years to do it. I was hooked, you see, Mr. Cable, as was my sister, because the company that manufactured the cigarettes that killed her and could have killed me intentionally kept the nicotine at a high level. Now, don't interrupt me, Mr. Cable. Nicotine in itself is not a carcinogen, you know that. It's just a poison that gets you addicted so the carcinogens can one day take care of you. That's why cigarettes are inherently dangerous.
Cable watched him with complete composure.
Are you finished?
I'm ready for the next question, but don't interrupt me again.
Certainly, and I apologize.
Now, when did you first become convinced that cigarettes were inherently dangerous? I don't know exactly. It's been known for some time, you know. It did not then and does not now take a genius to figure it out. But I'd say at some point in the early 70s, after I finished my study, after my sister had died, and shortly before I saw the infamous memo.
In 1973?
Somewhere in there.
When did your employment with Pinex cease? What year?
In 1982.
So you continued working for a company which made products you considered to be inherently dangerous?
I did.
What was your salary in 1982?
$90,000 a year.
Cable paused and walked to his table, where he was handed yet another yellow legal pad, which he studied for a second as he bit the stem of his reading glasses. Then he returned to the lectern and asked Krigler why he'd sued the company in 1982. Krigler didn't appreciate the question, and he looked at Rohr and Milton for help. Cable pursued details of the events leading up to the litigation, hopelessly complicated and personal litigation, and the testimony slowed to a virtual halt.
Rohr objected, and Milton objected, and Cable acted as if he couldn't understand why in the world they'd object. The lawyers met at the sidebar to haggle in private in front of Judge Harkin, and Krigler grew weary of the witness stand. Cable hammered away at Krigler's performance record during his last 10 years with Pinex and hinted strongly that other witnesses might be called to contradict him. The ploy almost worked. Unable to shake the damaging aspects of Krigler's testimony, the defense chose instead to blow smoke at the jury. If a witness is unshakable, then beat him up with insignificant details.
The ploy was explained to the jury, however, by young Nicholas Easter, who'd had 2 years of law school and chose to remind his colleagues of his experiences during a late afternoon coffee break. Over Herman's objections, Nicholas voiced his resentment at Cable for throwing mud and trying to confuse the jury.
"He thinks we're stupid," he said bitterly.
Chapter 17. In response to frantic calls from Biloxi, the price of Pinex shares dipped as low as 75.5 by closing Thursday, down almost 4 points in heavy trading attributed to the dramatic events in the courtroom. In other tobacco trials, former employees had testified about pesticides and insecticides sprayed on the crops, and experts had linked the chemicals to cancer. The juries had not been impressed. In one trial, a former employee had spilled the news that his former employer had targeted young teenagers with ads showing thin and glamorous idiots with perfect chins and perfect teeth having all manner of fun with tobacco. The same employer had targeted older teenaged males with ads depicting cowboys and stock car drivers seriously pursuing life with cigarettes stuck between their lips. But the juries in those trials did not award the plaintiffs. No former employee, though, did as much damage as Lawrence Krigler. The infamous memo from the 1930s had been seen by a handful of people, but never produced in litigation. Krigler's version of it for the jury was as close as any plaintiff's lawyer had come to the real thing. The fact that he'd been allowed by Judge Harkin to describe it to the jury would be hotly contested on appeal, regardless of who won at trial. Krigler was quickly escorted out of town by Rohr security people, and an hour after finishing his testimony, he was on a private plane back to Florida. Several times since leaving Pinex, he had been tempted to contact a plaintiff's lawyer in a tobacco trial, but had never mustered the courage. Pinex had paid him $300,000 out of court just to get rid of him. The company had insisted he agree never to testify in trials similar to Wood, but he refused. And when he refused, he became a marked man. They, whoever they had been, said they'd kill him. The threats had been few and scattered over the years, always from unknown voices and always dropping in when least expected. Krigler was not one to hide. He'd written a book, an exposé, he said, would be published in the event of his untimely death. A lawyer had it in Melbourne Beach. The lawyer was a friend who'd arranged the initial meeting with Rohr. The lawyer had also opened a dialogue with the FBI, just in case something happened to Mr. Krigler. Millie Dupree's husband, Hoppy, owned a struggling realty agency in Biloxi. Certainly not the aggressive sort, he had few listings and few leads, but he worked diligently with what little business came his way. One wall in the front room had pictures of available opportunities thumbtacked to a corkboard, mainly little brick houses with neat lawns and a few run-down duplexes. Casino fever had brought to the coast a new herd of real estate swingers, unafraid to borrow heavily and develop accordingly. Once again, Hoppy and the little guys had played it safe and got themselves squeezed even further into markets they knew all too well. Darling little starters for the newlyweds, and hopeless fix-ups for the desperate, and motivated sellers for those who couldn't qualify for a bank loan. But he paid his bills and somehow provided for his family. His wife Millie and their five kids, three at the junior college and two in high school. At any given time, he had attached to his office the licenses of half a dozen part-time sales associates, for the most part a downhearted bunch of losers who shared his aversion to debt and forcefulness. Hoppy loved pinochle, and many hours were passed at his desk in the back over cards as subdivisions sprang up all around him. Realtors, regardless of their talent, loved to dream of the big score. Hoppy and his motley gang were not above taking a late afternoon nip and talking big business over cards. Just before 6 on Thursday, as the pinochle was winding down and preparations were being made to end another non-productive day, a well-dressed young businessman with a shiny black attaché entered the office and asked for Mr. Dupree. Hoppy was in the back, rinsing his mouth with scope and hurrying to get home since Millie was locked away. Introductions were made. The young man presented a business card which declared him to be Todd Ringwald of KLX Property Group out of Las Vegas, Nevada. The card impressed Hoppy enough to shoo off the last of the lingering sales associates and lock his office door. The mere presence of one dressed so well and having traveled such a great distance could only mean serious matters were possible. Hoppy offered a drink, then coffee, which could be brewed in an instant. Mr. Ringwald declined and asked if he'd come at a bad time.
No, not at all. We work crazy hours, you know. It's a crazy business.
Mr. Ringwald smiled and agreed because he too was once in business for himself, not too many years ago. First, a bit about his company. KLX was a private outfit with holdings in a dozen states. While it did not own casinos and had no plans to do so, it had developed a related specialty, a lucrative one. KLX tracked casino development. Hoppy nodded furiously as if this type of enterprise was altogether familiar to him. Typically, when casinos move in, the local real estate market changes dramatically. Ringwald was certain Hoppy knew all about this, and Hoppy agreed wholeheartedly as if he'd made a fortune recently. KLX moved in quietly, and Ringwald emphasized just how utterly secretive the company was, a step behind the casinos, and developed shopping areas and expensive condos and apartment complexes and upper-end subdivisions. Casinos pay well, employ many, things change in the local economy. And, well, there's just a hell of a lot more money floating around, and KLX wanted its share.
Our company is a vulture, Ringwald explained with a devious smile. We sit back and watch the casinos. When they move, we go in for the kill.
Brilliant, Hoppy offered, unable to control himself.
However, KLX had been slow to move on the coast, and confidentially this had cost a few jobs back in Vegas. There were still incredible opportunities, though, to which Hoppy said, "There certainly are."
Ringwald opened his briefcase and removed a folded property map, which he held on his knees. He, as vice president of development, preferred to deal with smaller realty agents. The big firms had too many people hanging around, too many overweight housewives reading classifieds and waiting for the slightest morsel of gossip.
"You got that right," Hoppy said, staring at the property map. "Plus you get better service from a small agency like mine."
"You have been highly recommended," Ringwald said, and Hoppy couldn't suppress a smile. The phone rang. It was the senior in high school, wanting to know what was for supper and when might Mother be coming home. Hoppy was pleasant, but short. He was very busy, he explained, and there might be some old lasagna in the freezer. The property map was unfolded on Hoppy's desk. Ringwald pointed to a large red-colored plot in Hancock County, next door to Harrison and the westernmost of the three coastal counties. Both men hovered over the desk from different sides. "MGM Grand is coming here," Ringwald said, pointing to a large bay. "But no one knows it yet. You certainly can't tell anyone."
Hoppy's head was shaking hell no before Ringwald finished.
"They're going to build the biggest casino on the coast, probably middle of next year. They'll announce in 3 months. They'll buy 100 acres or so of this land here."
"That's beautiful land, virtually untouched."
Hoppy had never been near the property with a real estate sign, but he had lived on the coast for 40 years. "We want this," Ringwald said, pointing again to the land marked in red. It was adjacent to the north and west of the MGM land. 500 acres. "So we can do this." He pulled the top sheet back to reveal an artist's rendering of a rather splendid planned unit development. It was labeled Stillwater Bay, with bold blue letters across the top. Condos, office buildings, big homes, smaller homes, playgrounds, churches, a central square, a shopping mall, a pedestrian mall, a dock, a marina, a business block, parks, jogging paths, bike trails, even a proposed high school. It was utopia, all planned for Hancock County by some wonderfully far-sighted people in Las Vegas.
"Wow," Hoppy said.
There was a bloody fortune on his desk. 4 different phases over 5 years. The whole thing will cost $30 million. It's by far the biggest development ever seen in these parts.
"Nothing can touch it."
Ringwald flipped another page and revealed another drawing of the dock area, then another for a close-up of the residential section. "These are just the preliminary drawings. I'll show you more if you can come to the home office."
"Vegas?"
"Yes. If we can reach an agreement on your representation, then we'd like to fly you out for a few days. You know, meet our people, see the whole project from the design end." Hoppy's knees wobbled, and he took a breath. "Slow down," he told himself.
"Yes, and what type of representation did you have in mind?"
"Initially, we need a broker to handle the purchase of the land. Once we buy it, we have to convince the local authorities to approve the development. This, as you know, can take time and become controversial. We spend a lot of time before planning commissions and zoning boards. We even go to court when necessary, but it's just part of our business. You'll be involved to some extent at this point. Once it's approved, we'll need a real estate firm to handle the marketing of Stillwater Bay." Hoppy backed into his chair and pondered figures for a moment.
"How much will the land cost?" he asked.
"It's expensive. Much too expensive for this area. $10,000 an acre for a land worth about half that much."
$10,000 an acre for 500 acres added up to $5 million, 6% of which was $300,000 for Hoppy's commission, assuming, of course, no other realtors were to be involved.
Ringwald watched, poker-faced, as Hoppy did the mental math.
"$10,000's too much," Hoppy said with authority.
"Yes, but the land is not on the market. The sellers don't really want to sell, so we have to sneak in quickly before the MGM story leaks and snatch it. That's why we need a local agent. If word hits the street that a big company from Vegas is looking at the land, it'll go to $20,000 an acre.
happens all the time. The fact that the land was not on the market caused Hoppy's heart to stutter. No other realtors were involved, just him. Just little Hoppy and his full 6% commission. His ship had finally come in. He, Hoppy Dupree, after decades of selling duplexes to pensioners, was about to make a killing. Not to mention the marketing of Stillwater Bay. All those houses and condos and commercial properties. Hell, $30 million worth of red-hot property with Dupree Realty signs hanging all over it. Hoppy could be a millionaire in 5 years, he decided on the spot. Ringwald moved in.
I'm assuming your commission is 8%. That's what we normally pay.
Of course, Hoppy said, the words rushing forward over a very dry tongue. From 300,000 to 400,000, just like that.
Who are the sellers?
He asked, quickly changing the subject now that they'd agreed on 8%.
Ringwald allowed a noticeable sigh, and his shoulders sagged, but only for an instant.
This is where it gets complicated. Hoppy's heart sank.
The property is in the 6th District of Hancock County, Ringwald said slowly. And the 6th District is the domain of a county supervisor by the name of
Jimmy Hull Moak,
Hoppy interrupted with no small measure of sadness.
You know him?
Everybody knows Jimmy Hull. He's been in office for 30 years, slickest crook on the coast.
Do you know him personally?
No, only by reputation.
Which we've heard is rather shady.
Shady is a compliment to Jimmy Hull. On a local level, the man controls everything in his end of the county.
Ringwald offered a puzzled look, as if he and his company had no clue about how to proceed. Hoppy rubbed his sad eyes and plotted to keep his fortune. They made no eye contact for a full minute. Then Ringwald said,
"It's not wise to buy the land unless we can get some assurances from Mr. Moak and the local people. As you know, there will be a maze of regulatory approvals for the project.
Planning, zoning, architectural review, soil erosion, you name it," Hoppy said, as if he fought these wars every day.
"We've been told that Mr. Moak controls all of this."
"With an iron fist."
Another pause. "Perhaps we should arrange a meeting with Mr. Moak," Ringwald said.
"I don't think so."
"Why not?"
"Meetings don't work."
"I'm not following you."
"Cash. Pure and simple. Jimmy Hull likes it under the table. Large sacks of it in unmarked bills."
Ringwald nodded with a solemn grin, as if this was unfortunate but not unexpected.
"So we've heard," he said almost to himself. "Actually, this is not unusual, especially in areas where casinos have appeared. There's lots of fresh foreign money, and people get greedy."
"Jimmy Hull was born greedy. He was stealing 30 years before casinos appeared here."
"He doesn't get caught?"
"No. For a local supervisor, he's pretty bright. Everything's in cash, no trail, he covers himself carefully. Then again, it doesn't take a rocket scientist."
Hoppy tapped his forehead lightly with a handkerchief. He bent forward and removed 2 tumblers from a lower drawer, then a bottle of vodka. He poured 2 stiff drinks and placed 1 across the desk in front of Ringwald.
"Cheers,"
he said before Ringwald touched his glass.
"So what do we do?" Ringwald asked.
"What do you normally do in situations like this?"
"We normally find a way to work with the local authorities. There's too much money involved to pack up and go home."
"How do you work with local authorities?"
"We have ways. We have contributed money to re-election campaigns. We have honored our friends with expensive vacations. We've paid consulting fees to spouses and children."
"You ever paid bribes in hard cash?"
"Well, I'd rather not say."
"That's what it'll take. Jimmy Hall's a simple man. Just cash."
Hoppy took a long sip and smacked his lips.
"How much?"
"Who knows? But it'd better be enough. You lowball him up front, he'll kill your project later. And he'll keep the cash. Jimmy Hull doesn't do refunds."
"You sound like you know him rather well."
"Those of us who wheel and deal along the coast know how he plays the game. He's sort of a local legend."
Ringwald shook his head in disbelief.
"Welcome to Mississippi," Hoppy said, then took another sip.
Ringwald had not touched his drink. For 25 years, Hoppy had played it straight, and he had no plans to compromise himself now. The money wasn't worth the risk. He had kids, a family, a reputation, standing in the community, church occasionally, the Rotary Club. And just exactly who was this stranger sitting across his desk in the fancy suit and designer loafers, offering the world if only one minor agreement could be reached? He, Hoppy, would certainly get on the phone and check out KLX Property Group and Mr. Todd Ringwald as soon as he left the office. "This is not unusual," Ringwald said. "We see it all the time."
"Then what do you do?"
"Well, I think our first step is to approach Mr. Moak and determine the likelihood of a deal."
"Well, he'll be ready to deal."
"Then we determine the terms of the deal. As you put it, we'll decide how much cash." Ringwald paused and took a tiny sip of his drink. "Are you willing to be involved?"
"I don't know. In what way?"
"We don't know anyone in Hancock County. We try to keep a low profile. We're from Vegas. If we start asking questions, then the entire project gets blown."
"You want me to talk to Jimmy Hull?"
"Only if you want to be involved. If not, then we'll be forced to find someone else."
"I have a clean reputation," Hoppy said with astounding firmness, then swallowed hard at the thought of a competitor raking in his $400,000.
"We don't expect you to get dirty." Ringwald paused and groped for the right words. Hoppy was pulling for him. "Let's just say that we have ways of delivering what Mr. Moak wants. You won't have to touch it. In fact, you won't know when it happens." Hoppy sat straighter as a burden lifted itself from his shoulders. Perhaps there was some middle ground here. Ringwald and his company did this all the time. They'd probably dealt with crooks much more sophisticated than Jimmy Hull Moak.
"I'm listening," he said.
"Your fingers are on the pulse here. We're obviously outsiders, so we'll rely on you. Let me give you a scenario. You tell me if it'll work. What if you meet with Mr. Moak, just the two of you, and you tell him in broad strokes about the development? Our names are not mentioned. You simply have this client who wants to work with him. He'll name his price. If it's within our range, then you tell him it's a deal. We'll take care of the delivery, and you never know for certain if the cash actually changes hands. You've done nothing wrong. He's happy. We're happy because we're about to make a pot full of money, along with you, I might add." Hoppy liked it. None of the mud could stick to his hands. Let his client and Jimmy Hull do their dirty work. He'd stay out of the gutter and simply turn his head. Still, he was overcome by caution. He said he'd like to think about it. They chatted some more, looked at the plans once again, and said goodbye at 8. Ringwald was to call early Friday morning. Before heading home, Hoppy dialed the number on Ringwald's business card. An efficient receptionist in Las Vegas said, "Good afternoon, KLX Property Group." Hoppy smiled, then asked to speak to Todd Ringwald. The call was routed, with soft rock in the background, to Mr. Ringwald's office, where Hoppy spoke to Madeline, an assistant of some variety, who explained that Mr. Ringwald was out of town and not expected back until Monday. She asked who was calling, and Hoppy quickly hung up. There now. KLX was indeed legitimate. Incoming phone calls were stopped at the front desk, where they were recorded on yellow message slips and forwarded to Lou Dell, who then distributed them like the Easter Bunny passing out chocolate eggs. The one from George Teeker arrived at 7:40 Thursday night and was delivered to Lonnie Shaver, who was skipping the movie and working with his computer. He called Teeker at once, and for the first 10 minutes answered nothing but questions about the trial. Lonnie confessed that it had been a bad day for the defense. Lawrence Krigler had made a noticeable impact on the jurors. All except for Lonnie, of course. Lonnie had not been impressed, he assured Teeker. "The folks in New York were certainly worried," Teeker said more than once. "They're awfully relieved that Lonnie was on the jury and could be counted on no matter what. But things looked dim. Or did they?" Lonnie said it was too early to tell. Teeker said they needed to tie up the loose ends of the employment contract. Lonnie could think of only one loose end, and that was how much his new salary would be. He currently made $40,000. Teeker said Superhouse would raise him to $50,000 with some stock options and a performance-based bonus that might hit $20,000. They wanted him to start a management training course in Charlotte as soon as the trial was over. Mention of the trial brought on another round of questions about the mood of the jury. An hour later, Lonnie stood at his window, watched the parking lot, and tried to convince himself he was about to earn $70,000 a year. 3 years ago, he made $25,000. Not bad for a kid whose father drove a milk truck for $3 an hour. Chapter 18. On Friday morning, the Wall Street Journal ran a front-page story about Lawrence Krigler and his testimony of the day before. Written by Agner Layson, who'd so far not missed a word of the trial, the story did a fair job of describing what the jury heard. Then Layson speculated about Krigler's impact on the jury. The remaining half of the article tried to peel skin off Krigler with quotes from the good old boys at Compaq, formerly Allegheny Growers. Not surprisingly, there were vehement denials of almost everything Krigler said. The company had not conducted a study of nicotine in the 1930s, or at least no one around now knew about any such study. It was a long time ago. No one at Compaq had ever seen the infamous memo, probably just a figment of Krigler's imagination. It was not common knowledge in the tobacco industry that nicotine was addictive. Levels of the poison were not kept artificially high by Compaq or any other manufacturer for that matter. The company would not admit, in fact denied again in print, that nicotine was addictive in the first place. Pinex also delivered a few potshots, all from unnamed sources. Krigler was a corporate misfit. He fancied himself a serious scientific researcher when in fact he was just an engineer. His work with Raleigh 4 was seriously flawed. Production of that leaf was totally impractical. The death of his sister seriously affected his work and conduct. He was quick to threaten litigation. There was a strong hint that the out-of-court settlement 13 years earlier had been heavily weighted in Pinex's favor. A short, related story tracked the movement of Pinex Common, which had closed at 75.5, down 3 points in heavy trading after a late rally. Judge Harkin read the story an hour before the jury arrived. He called Lou Dell at the Siesta Inn to make sure there was no way any of the jurors could see it. She assured him they would get only the local dailies, all censored as per his instructions. She rather enjoyed cutting out the stories about the trial. Occasionally, she would scissor out an unrelated story, just for the fun of it, just to make them wonder what they were missing. How could they ever know? Hoppy Dupree slept little. After washing the dishes and vacuuming the den, he talked to Millie on the phone for almost an hour. She was in good spirits. He left his bed at midnight to sit on the porch and ponder KLX and Jimmy Hull Moke and the fortune that was out there, almost within reach. The money would be used for the kids, he had determined before he left the office. No more junior colleges, no more part-time jobs. They'd have the best schools. A larger house would be nice, but only because the kids were cramped. He and Millie could live anywhere, such simple tastes. No debt whatsoever. After taxes, he'd put the money in two places, mutual funds and real estate. He'd buy small commercial properties with solid leases. He could think of a half a dozen already. The agreement with Jimmy Hull Moke worried him to no end. He'd simply never been involved with graft, never to his knowledge gotten near it. He had a cousin who sold used cars and got himself sent away for 3 years for double and triple mortgaging his inventory. Wrecked his marriage, ruined his children. At some point before dawn, he became oddly comforted by the reputation of Jimmy Hull Moke. The man had fine-tuned the practice of corruption and made it an art form. He had become quite wealthy on a meager public servant's salary, and everybody knew it. Surely Moke would know precisely how to handle the agreement without getting caught. Hoppy wouldn't get near the cash, wouldn't even know for sure if and when it was delivered. He ate a Pop-Tart for breakfast and determined the risk to be minimal. He'd have a safe chat with Jimmy Hull, let the conversation run whatever course Jimmy Hull wanted, because they'd soon enough get to the issue of cash, and then he'd report to Ringwald. He thawed frozen cinnamon swirls for the kids, left their lunch money on the kitchen counter, and went to the office at 8.
For the day after Krigler, the defense adopted a gentler style. It was imperative to seem relaxed, unbothered by the severe blow the plaintiff had delivered yesterday. A pack of them wore suits of lighter shades, soft grays and blues, and even a khaki. Gone were the harsh blacks and navies, gone too were the serious frowns of men overburdened with their own importance. The instant the door opened and the first juror appeared, wide, toothy smiles appeared from behind the defense table. Even a couple of chuckles. What a laid-back bunch. Judge Harkins said hello, but there were few smiles inside the jury box. It was Friday, which meant the weekend started soon, a weekend to be spent incarcerated at the Siesta Inn. It had been decided over breakfast that Nicholas would pass a note to the judge and ask him to explore the possibility of working Saturday. The jurors would rather be in court trying to finish this ordeal than sitting around their rooms doing nothing but thinking about it. Most of them noticed the stupid grins from Cable and Company. They noticed the summer suits, the jovial air, the humorous whispers. "Why are they so damned happy?" Lorene Duke whispered under her breath as Harkin read his list of questions. "They want us to think everything's under control," Nicholas whispered back. "Just glare at them." Wendell Rohr stood and called the next witness.
"Dr. Roger Bunch," he said with an air of greatness.
He watched the jury for reactions to the name. It was Friday. There would be no reactions from the jury. Bunch had gained fame a decade earlier when, as Surgeon General of the United States, he had been a relentless critic of the tobacco industry. For the 6 years he'd served, he had instigated countless studies, directed frontal assaults, given 1,000 anti-smoking speeches, written 3 books on the subject, and pushed agencies for tougher regulatory controls. His victories had been few and far between. Since leaving office, he had continued his crusade with a talent for publicity. He was a man of many opinions, and he was anxious to share them with the jury. The evidence was conclusive. Cigarettes caused lung cancer. Every professional medical organization in the world that had addressed the issue had determined that smoking cigarettes caused lung cancer. The only organizations with contrary opinions were the manufacturers themselves and their hired mouthpieces, lobbying groups and the like. Cigarettes are addictive. Ask any smoker who's tried to quit. The industry claims smoking is a matter of free choice. Typical hogwash from the tobacco companies, he said with disgust. In fact, during his 6 years as Surgeon General, he released 3 separate studies, each of which proved conclusively that cigarettes are addictive. Tobacco companies spend billions misleading the public. They conduct studies which claim to prove smoking is virtually harmless. They spend $2 billion a year on advertising alone, then claim people make informed choices about whether or not to smoke. It's simply not true. People, especially teenagers, receive confusing signals. Smoking appears to be fun, sophisticated, even healthy. They spend tons of money on all sorts of screwball studies which they claim will prove whatever they're asserting. The industry as a whole is notorious for lying and covering up. The companies refuse to stand behind their products. They advertise and promote like mad, but when one of their customers dies from lung cancer, they claim the person should have known better. Bunch did a study proving cigarettes contain insecticide and pesticide residue, asbestos fibers, unidentified junk and trash swept from floors. While sparing no expense on advertising, the companies do not go to the trouble and expense of properly cleaning poisonous residues from their tobacco. He directed a project which showed how tobacco companies elusively target the young, how they target the poor, how they develop and advertise certain brands for the different sexes and classes. Because he was once the Surgeon General, Dr. Bunch was permitted to share his opinions on a wide range of subjects. At times, throughout the morning, he was unable to conceal his loathing for the tobacco industry, and when the bitterness leaked through, his credibility suffered. But he connected with the jury. There were no yawns or blank stares. Todd Ringwald was of the firm opinion that the meeting should take place in Hoppy's office, on his turf, where Jimmy Hull-Moak would be caught off guard. Hoppy presumed this made sense. He was really at a loss for the proper customs in these matters. He got lucky and found Moke at home, puttering with his bush hog and heading on over to Biloxi later in the day anyway. Moke claimed he knew of Hoppy, had heard of him at some point. Hoppy said it was a very important matter involving a potentially big development in Hancock County. They agreed on lunch, a quick sandwich in Hoppy's office. Moke said he knew exactly where Hoppy was located. For some reason, three part-time sales associates loitered in the front of the office as noon approached. One chatted with a boyfriend on the phone, one scanned the classifieds, one was apparently waiting for the pinochle. With great difficulty, Hoppy dispatched them to the streets where the real estate was to be found. He didn't want anyone around when Moke appeared. The offices were deserted when Jimmy Hull walked through the door in jeans and cowboy boots. Hoppy greeted him with a nervous handshake and a jittery voice and showed him to his office in the back where his desk was set with two deli sandwiches and iced teas. They talked about local politics, casinos, and fishing as they ate, though Hoppy's appetite was nil, his stomach flipped with fear and his hands wouldn't stop shaking. He then cleared the desk and produced the artist rendering of Stillwater Bay. Ringwald had delivered it earlier, and it contained no clue as to who was behind the project. Hoppy gave a quick 10-minute summary of the proposed development and found himself getting stronger. He made a very nice presentation, if he said so himself. Jimmy Hull stared at the drawing, rubbed his chin, and said,
$30 million, huh?
At least, Hoppy answered. His bowels were suddenly loose.
And who's done it?
Hoppy had practiced his answer, and he delivered it with convincing authority. He simply couldn't divulge the name, not at this point. Jimmy Hull liked the secrecy. He asked questions, all of which had to do with money and financing. Hoppy answered most of them.
"Zoning could be a real problem," Jimmy Hull said with a frown.
"Certainly.
And the Planning Commission will put up a nasty fight."
"We expect this."
"Of course, the supervisors make the final decision. As you know, the recommendations from zoning and planning are merely advisory. Bottom line is the six of us do whatever we want."
He snickered, and Hoppy laughed along. In Mississippi, the six county supervisors ruled supreme.
"My client understands how things work, and my client is anxious to work with you."
Jimmy Hull removed his elbows from the desk and sat back in his chair. His eyelids narrowed, his forehead wrinkled. He stroked his chin, and his beady black eyes shot lasers across the desk and hit poor Hoppy like hot bullets deep in the chest. Hoppy pressed all 10 fingers onto the desk so his hands wouldn't tremble. How many times had Jimmy Hull been at this particular moment, sizing up the prey before going in for the kill?
"You know I control everything in my district," he said, his lips barely moving.
"I know exactly how things work," Hoppy replied as coolly as possible.
"If I want this to be approved, it'll slide right through. If I don't like it, it's dead right now."
Hoppy only nodded. Jimmy Hull was curious about what other locals were involved at this point. Who knew what? Just how secret was the project right then?
"No one but me," Hoppy assured him.
"Is your client in gambling?"
"No, but they're from Vegas. They know how to get things done at the local level, and they are anxious to move fast."
Vegas was the operative word here, and Jimmy Hull savored it. He looked around the shabby little office. It was spare and Spartan and conveyed a certain innocence, as if not much happened here and not much was expected. He had called two friends in Biloxi, both of whom reported that Mr. Dupree was a harmless sort who sold fruitcakes at Christmas for the Rotary Club. He had a large family and managed to avoid controversy, and commerce generally, for that matter. The obvious question was, why would the boys behind Stillwater Bay associate themselves with a mom-and-pop outfit like Dupree Realty? He decided not to ask the question.
He said, "You know my son is a very fine consultant for projects like this."
"Didn't know that. My client would love to work with your son.
He's over in Bay St. Louis.
Shall I give him a call?"
"No, I'll handle it."
Randy Moak owned 2 gravel trucks and spent most of his time tinkering with a fishing boat he advertised for saltwater charters. He had dropped out of high school 2 months before his first drug conviction. Hoppy pressed on. Ringwald had insisted he try and pin down Moak as soon as possible. If a deal wasn't reached initially, then Moak might race back to Hancock County and start talking about the development.
"My client is anxious to determine the preliminary fees before purchasing the land. How much might your son charge for his services?"
$100,000.
Hoppy didn't flinch a muscle and was quite proud of his coolness. Ringwald had predicted a shakedown in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $200,000. KLX would gladly pay it. Frankly, it was cheap compared to New Jersey.
"I see. Payable
in cash.
My client is willing to discuss this."
"No discussion. Cash up front or no deal."
"And the deal being?"
$100,000 cash now, and the project sails through. My guarantee, a penny less, and I'll kill it with one phone call."
Remarkably, there was not the slightest trace of menace in his voice or face. Hoppy told Ringwald later that Jimmy Hull simply laid out the terms of the deal as if he were selling used tires at a flea market.
"I need to make a phone call," Hoppy said. "Just sit tight."
He walked to the front room, which was thankfully still deserted, and called Ringwald, who was sitting by the phone in his hotel. The terms were relayed, discussed only for a few seconds, and Hoppy returned to his office.
"It's a deal. My client will pay it."
He said this slowly, and frankly, it felt good to finally broker a deal that would lead to millions. KLX on one end, Moak on the other, and Hoppy in the middle of it all, in the fire and totally immune from the dirty work. Jimmy Hull's face relaxed, and he managed a smile.
"When?"
"I'll call you Monday."
Chapter 19. Fitch ignored the trial Friday afternoon. There were urgent matters at hand with one of his jurors. He, along with Pang and Carl Nussman, locked themselves in a conference room at Cable's office and stared at the wall for an hour. The idea had been Fitch's, and his alone. It was a shot in the dark, one of his wildest hunches yet. But he got paid to dig under rocks no one else could find. Money gave him the luxury of dreaming the improbable. 4 days earlier, he had ordered Nussman to ship overnight to Biloxi the entire jury file from the Cimino trial a year before in Allentown, Pennsylvania. The Cimino jury had listened to 4 weeks of testimony, then handed the tobacco company another verdict. 300 potential jurors had been summoned for duty in Allentown. One of them was a young man named David Lancaster. The file on Lancaster was thin. He worked in a video store and claimed to be a student. He lived in an apartment over a struggling Korean deli and apparently traveled by bicycle. There was no evidence of another vehicle, and the county rolls reflected no taxes levied on any car or truck titled in his name. His jury information card stated he was born in Philadelphia on May 8, 1967, though this had not been verified at the time of the trial. There had been no reason to suspect he was lying. Nussman's people had just determined that the birth date was, in fact, fictitious. The card also stated he was not a convicted felon, had not served on jury duty in the county in the past year, had no medical reasons not to serve, and was a duly qualified elector. He had registered to vote 5 months before the trial started. There was nothing strange in the file except a handwritten memo from a consultant which said that when Lancaster appeared for jury duty on the first day, the clerk had no record of his being summoned. He then produced what appeared to be a valid summons, and he was seated with the pool. One of Nussman's consultants noted that Lancaster seemed quite anxious to serve. The only photo of the young man was one taken from a distance as he rode his mountain bike to work. He wore a cap, dark sunglasses, long hair, and a heavy beard. One of Nussman's operatives chatted with Lancaster as she rented videos and reported him to be dressed in faded jeans, Birkenstocks, wool socks, and a flannel shirt. The hair was pulled back severely in a ponytail and tucked under his collar. He was polite, but not talkative. Lancaster got a bad draw when the numbers were pulled, but made the first 2 cuts, and was 4 rows away when the jury was chosen. His file was closed immediately. Now it was open again.
In the past 24 hours, it had been determined that David Lancaster had simply vanished from Allentown a month after the trial was over. His Korean landlord knew nothing. His boss at the video store said he failed to show up for work one day and was never heard from again. Not another person in town could be found who would admit to knowing Lancaster ever existed. Fitch's people were checking, but no one expected to find anything. He was still registered to vote, but the rolls wouldn't be purged for another 5 years, according to the county registrar. By Wednesday night, Fitch was all but certain David Lancaster was Nicholas Easter. Early Thursday morning, Nussman had received from his office in Chicago two large boxes, which contained the jury file from the Glavine trial in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Glavine had been